Hello and welcome to our Krauscast webinar series. My name is Elisa Lamel and I'm the legal content specialist here at Kraus Financial Services. Today's topic is crisis Medicaid planning strategies for a married couple, hosted by our senior relationship manager, Erin Kempen. Before we get started, we do have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, please feel free to type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Additionally, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you take a moment to complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screen at the end of the presentation, as we truly do appreciate that feedback. And now let's get to today's presentation. Erin, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Lisa. Hello, everyone. I'm Erin Kempen with Kraus Financial Services. Just a little quick thing about me before we get started. I've been with Kraus Financial around 12 years now. It's been a while. When I first started with the company, I was what we refer to in-house as one of the benefits planners. So I would be the individual that would put together the financial plan in order to qualify your clients for Medicaid benefits. Now, in my current role, I focus most of my time on traveling to various elder law and estate planning events across the country, doing webinars such as this, and really educating new to Medicaid planning, new to Kraus Financial attorneys, on how to utilize our products and services to effectively protect their clients' assets while qualifying your clients for Medicaid benefits. Kraus Financial Services has been in this space for over 30 years, and we specialize again in financial solutions in order to qualify your clients for long-term care benefits. Our primary offerings include Medicaid compliant annuities, funeral expense trusts, long-term care insurance, and we have a wealth of educational resources that can be found on our website. So if you haven't done so already, I encourage you all to create a free attorney access account by going to medicaidannuity.com. As again, there's a wealth of educational material on there. So now, today's presentations, our goals is to discuss the Medicaid program and its eligibility requirements. Then we'll go over a couple Medicaid planning strategies for a married couple in order to accelerate, again, your client's Medicaid eligibility and protect as much of their assets as possible. And then finally, we'll wrap it up. We'll put some meat on the bones and go over a couple case studies to add some numbers to everything and to wrap everything up. So getting started with the Medicaid program, we'll just provide a quick overview of the Medicaid program for those of you who may not be aware. So what is Medicaid? Medicaid is a joint federal and state program for those that have limited means. And when we're focusing on this presentation today, we're going to be focusing on Medicaid within a nursing home setting, so long-term care Medicaid benefits. There are very specific criteria in order to qualify for Medicaid benefits. There's both financial and non-financial criteria, and the state rules are going to vary from state to state. So the Medicaid planning that takes place in Wisconsin is going to be different than the Medicaid planning that takes place in Colorado. That'll be different than the Medicaid planning that takes place in Pennsylvania. So the rules are going to be somewhat state specific, but the general strategies will all essentially be the same, but each state will have their own various nuances that you have to worry about. So again, if you go to medicaidannuity.com, create that free attorney access account, we can outline what your state specific Medicaid numbers and rules are. So again, it's a great resource. So why is Medicaid important? Why do we do this planning? Well, it really boils down to the cost of care. For a semi-private room, the national average is currently almost $8,000 per month. And if you're looking at a private room, you're looking at almost $9,000 per month. So if you put that on an annualized basis, you're looking at almost $100,000 per year for their care. And most individuals, especially individuals, elderly people in their last life stages, you know, they just don't have that amount saved up. They're not, you know, planning for, you know, $100,000 a year care costs. So people just don't have that wealth. And it's really becomes a financial burden on them. So the Medicaid program will help people pay for their care within a nursing home setting. And again, we both have non-financial and financial requirements to meet. So the non-financial eligibility requirements really are pretty straightforward. You have to be a US citizen or qualified alien, age 65 or older, blind and or disabled. You have to be a resident of in a Medicaid approved facility. So the first bullet point there, that's really out of these requirements is probably the most quote unquote difficult to meet. Although, so if you transfer someone into a nursing home, just make sure that nursing home facility accepts Medicaid benefits. So with the financial requirements, this is where most people struggle. And the financial requirements are broken down into two categories. We have income and assets. And there's a specific set of rules for both the income criteria and the asset criteria. And since we are talking about married couples, each spouse, so the institutionalized spouse, the one that's in the facility, and the community spouse, the ones living at home, are each gonna have their own separate set of income and asset criteria as well. And we'll go over both of those criteria. And it is important to realize that when you're talking about the financial requirements, that something is either considered an asset or an income. It's not going to be considered both. So it's either going to be an asset or an income, not both. So starting with the institutionalized individual and their income requirements. So this is going to be the individual that is in the nursing home that you're going to be applying for Medicaid benefits on behalf of. So in most states, the institutionalized individual's income must just be less than the private pay rate at the facility. Now, in some states, about half the states, if the institutionalized individual's gross income exceeds $2,742 per month, you must set up a qualified income trust, or also known as a Miller trust, for any income exceeding that amount. And essentially all the institutionalized person's income, and when we're talking about income, we're really referring to like Social Security, pension, if you're in a state that has exempt IRAs and they are requiring minimum distributions, those will all be considered income sources. Again, we're talking about elderly people in nursing homes, so it's the typical income sources are gonna be Social Security and or pension. But know that basically all of their income, minus a few deductions, will go towards their nursing home share of costs each and every month. And this is known as their share of costs or the Medicaid copay. So it'll be all their income, less a small amount known as the personal needs allowance, which is an amount they're allowed to keep each and every month to spend on personal items. You can deduct medical expenses, think insurance premiums, some Medicare supplements like Medicare Part B, Part D, that stuff, and with their spouse, if the spouse has low income, we may be able to take income from the institutionalized person, move it over to the community spouse, so the community spouse can maintain their quality of life within the community. And the rule under this income shifting is known as the monthly maintenance needs allowance rule. So if the community spouse has low income, we may be able to shift income over to the community spouse so they can maintain their lifestyle within the community. So on the income requirements for the community spouse, if you are new to this type of planning, I would encourage you all to highlight, star, circle this first bullet point as it's pretty important, as you'll see later on, but there are no limits to the amount of income the community spouse may have. So the community spouse can effectively have unlimited income and will not affect the Medicaid eligibility of the institutionalized individual. However, in order to, the federal government did not want to impoverish the community spouse, so they did set forth a minimum level of income that the community spouse is entitled to, which is known as the monthly maintenance needs allowance. And again, if the community spouse's income falls below that monthly maintenance needs allowance, we'll be able to shift income from the institutionalized spouse dollar for dollar to bring the community spouse's income up to that minimum income threshold. If the community spouse's income exceeds the monthly managed needs allowance, that's completely acceptable. Again, the community spouse can have unlimited income. They would just not receive a shifting of income. So the monthly managed needs allowance, again, is a minimum level of income that the community spouse is entitled to maintain their lifestyle within the community. So if their income falls below this threshold, we can take income from the institutionalized spouse, shift it over to the community spouse to bring their income up to a minimum level. Now, depending what state you're in, some states, when you look at your monthly maintenance needs allowance, you will just see one number listed. Typically, if you just have one number, it'll be the maximum, which is currently $3,715.50. So in those states where you just have the one number, that's the monthly maintenance needs allowance. That's the amount of income the community spouse is entitled to. Now, there are other states that when you look at the monthly maintenance needs allowance, you'll see a minimum and a maximum figure. So this represents is the community spouse is always going to be entitled to the minimum monthly maintenance needs allowance, which is typically $2,465. However, if we can show what's referred to as excess shelter expenses, we can increase that minima up to the maximum minima of $3,715.50. So in a state where you see a minimum and a maximum figure, the community spouse is always entitled to that minimum figure. However, if we can show excess shelter expenses, we can increase the minimum up to that maximum. And again, this is just the amount of income the community spouse is entitled to. So they have income that exceeds that maximum figure. It's completely fine. They will just not receive a shifting of income. So to recap, income, the institutionalized person, basically the majority of their income is going to go towards their share of costs, and their income just needs to be less than the private pay rate. The community spouse may have unlimited income, and it's not going to affect the Medicaid eligibility of the institutionalized individual. However, if the community spouse's income falls below a certain threshold known as the monthly maintenance needs allowance, we can take income from the institutionalized individual, move it over to the community spouse, so the community spouse has a minimum level of income to live off of. Now let's switch gears and go to the other side of the sheet and talk about assets. So the asset requirements for the institutionalized individual, they're allowed a small amount, which is known as the individual resource allowance. And this number varies by state, but it's typically $2,000 of Conwell assets. So it's not very much. So the institutionalized individual typically can only have $2,000 of assets in their name in order to qualify for Medicaid benefits. Now, the community spouse, the healthy spouse at home, is allowed to retain a separate amount of assets known as the community spouse resource allowance. And this number, again, varies from state to state. And when you look at your community spouse resource allowance figures, if you just see one number listed for the community spouse resource allowance, that's the amount of assets the community spouse is allowed to have. However, in other states, kind of similar to that income, you'll see a minimum figure and a maximum figure. So if you're in one of those states with a minimum community spouse resource allowance and a maximum community spouse resource allowance, you have to do a little bit of math. So what you're going to do to determine how much the community spouse can keep is you're going to total up all the assets of the institutionalized individual and the community spouse as of a particular date known as the snapshot date, which I'll just we'll talk about in the next slide. What you're going to do is you're going to total up all the countable assets of the couple as a whole, and the community spouse is allowed to keep one half of the assets given the minimum and the maximum threshold. So for example, if the couple has $500,000 of total countable assets, one half of that would be $250,000. Since $250,000 is greater than the maximum CSRA of $148,620, the community spouse is allowed to keep only $148,620. The remainder would have to be spent down. If the couple had $200,000 of countable assets as of that snapshot date, one half of that would be $100,000. Since that falls between the minimum and the maximum community spouse resource allowance, the community spouse would be entitled to keep $100,000 of assets. And on the low end of the spectrum, if the couple had $40,000 of countable assets as of the snapshot date, Since one half of that would be $20,000, since it falls below the minimum figure, the community spouse would be entitled to the minimum amount of $29,724. Now, during that, I mentioned the snapshot date. So the snapshot date is a specific date in time, and it's the first date of a continuous period of institutionalization for at least 30 days. So let's say the institutionalized individual, an individual has a stroke, enters into a hospital to get the care that they needed to get cured of the stroke, and then they're transitioned directly into a nursing home and they stay there for the rest of their life. So the snapshot date is going to be the first day where that individual entered the nursing home. So we're going to look at the couple's assets as a whole on that date, the first date when he entered the hospital to get that care for his stroke. We're looking at the couple's assets as a whole, and the community spouse resource allowance is going to be based on the assets as of that particular date. And again, the community spouse is entitled to keep one half of the couple's total countable assets, assuming it falls between the minimum and the maximum range for your state. And again, if you're in a state that just has one number, that's the amount of assets the community spouse is allowed to keep. So now we know the asset limits. What's an exempt asset? What's a countable asset? What do we have to concern ourselves with? So the exempt assets, we do not take into consideration when determining Medicaid eligibility. They're exempt from these calculations. Exempt assets include the primary residence. They're allowed one vehicle. You can have personal property, so personal things that you find in your everyday in your home. And you're allowed to prepay funeral expenses. You can purchase a funeral expense trust in most states up to $15,000. And those would be exempt assets that Medicaid is not concerned with when doing these asset calculations. Now, on the other hand, the countable assets is going to be basically everything else. So you're talking about your checking accounts, your savings accounts, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, CDs, tax deferred annuities, if they have a vacation property or additional vehicles, those are all going to be countable assets. Now, IRAs, you're probably thinking, what about IRAs? And that really depends on the state. States vary wildly in how they treat IRAs. In some states, IRAs will be countable for both spouses. Other states, IRAs will be exempt for both spouses. And in some states, they'll be countable for one spouse and exempt for the other spouse. So again, this is where you're really going to want to look at your Medicaid rules to determine how IRAs are treated. They're treated wildly across the country. Can be either countable or exempt. So make sure you know how IRAs and other similar retirement accounts are going to be treated. So assets are typically the problem with, the institutionalized individual only allowed 2,000 and the community spouse typically allowed one half. What can you do? Assets are typically the issue. So how can you eliminate those assets? Well, you can certainly pay off any bills. So if you have a mortgage, you can pay off the mortgage, credit card debt, any other outstanding debts you may have. You may purchase or improve exempt assets. So if they have a home, or maybe they're in an apartment, they want to move into a home, so you can purchase a home for the community spouse. That's allowed. You can make home improvements. You can make the home more handicap and or elderly friendly, put a new roof on the home, upgrade the kitchen. You can do any of that stuff as long as it's done for fair market value. Maybe your clients are driving a 1996 Buick. We can upgrade that to a brand new Mercedes-Benz if you like. You can purchase more household furnishings. You can prepay funeral expenses, buy those funeral expense trusts. And finally, after all these spend downs you can do, my unbiased personal favorite and a quick and easy spend down tool is purchasing a Medicaid compliant annuity. So what exactly is a Medicaid compliant annuity? Well, a Medicaid compliant annuity is referred to as a single premium immediate annuity that has added restrictions that meet the requirements of the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. So the DRA of 2005 is a rule set that we have to play with. And what a Medicaid compliant annuity does is it will convert what Medicaid would normally view as an asset and simply convert it into a stream of income. So as you can imagine, usually assets are going to be the problem. So by converting excess assets into a stream of income, we can eliminate those assets and qualify the individual for Medicaid benefits. And depending on the situation and the case facts, we'll be dependent on how this Medicaid compliant annuity is used. And again, we'll cover a couple of planning strategies for a married couple. So in order for an annuity to be considered only income and not an asset or a transfer for less than fair market value, the annuity needs to meet 5 requirements. All 5 of these requirements need to be met, or otherwise the annuity will either be treated as a countable asset or a transfer for less than fair market value, which will be subject to a penalty. So the annuity needs to be irrevocable, non-assignable, actuarially sound, make equal payments, and have the state be named as a beneficiary in the proper position. So starting with irrevocable, the annuity needs to be completely irrevocable in every sense of the term. So once the annuity is purchased, everything about the contract is set in stone. So you cannot change the owner, you cannot change the annuitant, you may not change the payee, you may not change the term of the annuity, you may not add money to the annuity, you cannot change the beneficiaries of the annuity. So everything about the contract after its purchase is set in stone. You may not make any changes to it whatsoever. So that's the first one, irrevocable. The second one, non-assignable. There are some companies out there that will purchase annuities, life insurance, other forms of structured settlements. If you've watched daytime television, I'm sure you've heard some of the jingles on television. But in these Medicaid annuities, there is specific language within the contract that explicitly restricts the sale to a third party. So you cannot sell the future income stream. You cannot sell the contract on the secondary market to a third party. You cannot assign the payments to a third party. You cannot put the annuity up for collateral for a loan, so it's completely non-assignable. It has no secondary market, and it cannot be sold on the secondary market. The next requirement is the actuarially sound test. So the actuarially sound test, what that does is it establishes a maximum term for the annuity. So the term of the annuity cannot exceed the owners of the annuity's Medicaid life expectancy. So the Medicaid life expectancy is an age and gender-based table. And depending on what state you're in, your state may have its own Medicaid life expectancy table, or you may use the federal SSA table. So know which table your state uses, and then it's just age and gender-based. So you just look at the age of the individual purchasing the annuity and their gender, and it'll give you a number in a set of years. And to put that on a monthly basis, just multiply that number by 12, and you'll get the number of months for the maximum term the annuity may be purchased. So the actuarially sound rule establishes a maximum term, however, does not establish a minimum term. So you can purchase an annuity for less than their Medicaid life expectancy, just not greater than. So you can purchase up to or less than their Medicaid life expectancy, but not greater than the life expectancy. The next requirement is the annuity needs to make equal payments. So the first payment will be the exact same as the last payment. So you cannot have a deferral in payments. You cannot have a large balloon style payment at the end. And these types of annuities are going to make a fixed number of payments. So for example, if we use a 48-month Medicaid annuity, the annuity will make 48 equal monthly payments. The first payment will be the exact same as the 48th payment. Then after the 48th payment, the annuity is effectively closed out. It will not make a 49th payment. There's nothing left in the annuity. It's done. It's closed. It's gone. However, if the person were to predecease the term of the annuity and there's still payments remaining in the annuity, then the remaining payments would go to whomever would be named as beneficiary, which brings us to our final requirement. The state does have to be named as a beneficiary in the appropriate position in order for the annuity to be Medicaid compliant. So the state's gonna be named so they can recover for the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on behalf of the institutionalized individual in the event someone were to predecease the term of the annuity. Now, these beneficiary requirements depend on what individual is purchasing the annuity. So again, we're focusing on a married couple case. So if the communities, so there may always be a minor and or disabled child named before the state as beneficiary. So regardless if the community spouse is purchasing the annuity or the institutionalized spouse is purchasing the annuity, if they have a minor and or disabled child, you may always name that individual before the state as a beneficiary. So if the community spouse is purchasing the annuity, assuming they don't have a minor or disabled child, in most states, the state Medicaid agency will have to be named as a primary death beneficiary to the extent of benefits paid on behalf of the institutionalized individual. There are some states that will allow the institutionalized spouse to be named before the state when the community spouse is buying the annuity. So again, you're going to want to look at your state-specific Medicaid rules to determine if that's allowed. But in most states, the state will have to be named as primary death beneficiary. Now, when the institutionalized spouse is purchasing the annuity, we can name the community spouse as primary beneficiary with the state then being contingent. So if the institutionalized spouse is buying the annuity, we can always name the community spouse as primary beneficiary within the state being named contingent beneficiary. So that's one very nice thing about having the institutionalized spouse purchase the annuity. And this is just some examples of the beneficiary language again for the community spouse as the Medicaid annuity owner, primary beneficiary of the state Medicaid agency to the extent of benefits paid on behalf of the institutionalized spouse. If the institutionalized spouse is buying the annuity, the primary death beneficiary will be the community spouse. Then the secondary beneficiary will be the state Medicaid agency to the extent of benefits paid on behalf of the institutionalized individual. In either one of these situations, you may always name whomever you like after the state. So you may want to do that. So if the state has a claim and their claim is more in the annuity than the state's claim, then whatever is left in the annuity would get paid out to whomever will be named after the state. So, you know, typically the family or loved ones or whatever the wishes are. So now we'll get into strategies. So we're going to discuss two strategies today. The first strategy is we're going to have the institutionalized spouse purchase the Medicaid compliant annuity, and the other strategies will have the community spouse purchase the Medicaid compliant annuity. Then we'll compare and contrast those strategies. And again, we have some case studies to go over as well. So with the institutionalized spouse purchasing the Medicaid compliant annuity, it will be in their name. So they're eliminating the excess countable assets by purchasing the annuity. So they're creating an income stream for themselves. So typically when we have the institutionalized spouse purchase the annuity, we're going to want to structure the term of the annuity for as long as possible. So we're going to set it up for the full Medicaid life expectancy. The reason we want to do this is because we want to make that payment stream as long as possible. To make that payment as small as possible, because this is going to be income to the institutionalized spouse. So it's going to be considered their income. So it will be subject to their Medicaid copay amount. And the goal of purchasing the annuity in the name of the institutionalized spouse is to work that monthly maintenance needs allowance shift, to shift income over to the community spouse. So the community spouse, A, we're increasing their income, and we're eliminating a lot of this income by shifting it over to the community spouse. So less of it is going to their nursing home as their share of cost. And like we just went over with the beneficiary requirements, when the institutionalized spouse buys the MCA, we're able to name the community spouse as primary death beneficiary. So ultimately the institutionalized individual passes, assuming there's still payments left in the annuity and assuming the community spouse is still alive, they'll receive the remaining benefit in the annuity. So the pros and cons of this plan is, by buying the annuity in the institutionalized spouse's name and by stretching out that payment for as long as possible, I can't think of any argument that a state Medicaid agency would make as long as it meets the actuarially sound criteria with not exceeding life expectancy, but you're creating an income stream for the institutionalized spouse, thus subject to copay. So I don't know what the, you know, Medicaid agency may scrutinize about it. The other pro is upon the institutionalized spouse's death, again, the community spouse being named as primary death beneficiary can then receive the remaining payments or receive a lump sum distribution of the remaining amount in the annuity. One of the cons of this plan is it may not be beneficial if the community spouse has high income. So if the community spouse has high income and they're either not entitled to a minimum shift or be very little, you may not want to look into this plan. And it may not be suitable if the community spouse is expected to predecease the institutionalized individual, you're going to lose out on the benefit of when the institutionalized spouse ultimately dies, and the community spouse would then get the remaining benefits. If the community spouse predeceases the institutionalized individual, they're no longer going to be taken off as beneficiary, so the state would be able to recover what's remaining in the annuity. So those are some cons to the having the institutionalized spouse purchase the annuity. Now, flipping sides, we'll have the community spouse purchase the Medicaid annuity. Again, same structure, we're gonna have the community spouse purchase the Medicaid annuity with the full spend down amount. We're eliminating those excess countable assets and creating an income stream to the community spouse. Again, remember the community spouse can have unlimited income. So we really have a lot of flexibility when determining what term of annuity to purchase, because remember the actuary sound test sets a maximum term for the annuity, but not a minimum term. So we really have a lot of options and a lot of considerations to think about when purchasing a community spouse annuity. Some attorneys like to go on the shorter end to get the funds back to the community spouse relatively quickly, so that it will avoid any potential estate recovery. Because remember, the annuity is going to make a fixed number of payments. So the shorter the term of the annuity, the greater the probability the community spouse is going to outlive the annuity. And after that final payment, the annuity is closed. So there's not going to be any way for the state to recover from the annuity if there's nothing left in the annuity. You may want to go in a longer term. Maybe, the community spouse just likes the idea of having an income stream for as long as possible. So you might want to use a longer term there. Or maybe you want, the community spouse wants a specific amount of income each and every month to meet their living requirements or something like that. So there's a lot of options, and the goal really is just to have a conversation with your client to determine what you and the client are most comfortable with when it comes to choosing the term of a community spouse annuity. The average term we see when it comes to community spouse annuities nationwide is about 24 to 36 months. So take that for what it's worth. So some of the pros and cons of having the community spouse purchase the annuity. The community spouse has the opportunity to, again, create basically as much income as they need, so they can play with that term to if they want a larger payment or smaller payment. And we can structure the annuity so the community spouse gets the funds back relatively quickly. The downside is that the community spouse predeceases the term of the annuity. Unless there's a minor and or disabled child, more likely the state's going to have to be named as primary death beneficiary so that they'd be able to recover the amount of Medicaid benefits provided on behalf of the institutionalized individual. If you have a high premium and use a very short-term annuity, you may raise a proverbial red flag with the caseworker. There's no guidance saying an annuity can't be this short or a payment can't be, this large, but you may, offend the caseworker, and they may make that Medicaid application more difficult than it needs to be. Again, there's no legal rationale behind that, but, I've seen a lot of things from caseworkers before, so I wouldn't put it past them. And then upon the institutionalized spouse's death, it's going to have no bearing on the community spouse's annuity. So if you buy a 48-month Medicaid annuity and the institutionalized spouse dies after 12 months, there's still going to be 36 payments remaining in that community spouse annuity. The community spouse, as long as they're living, will receive the remaining amount of the payment. So there's no, it's not going to cancel upon the institutionalized person's passing. The community spouse is going to continue to receive those payments per the terms of the contract. All right, so now let's get into the case studies. Let's put some numbers around these strategies. But first, let's again talk about when each plan is appropriate. So you may want to purchase the Medicaid annuity for institutionalized spouses if the community spouse has a low monthly income and they're able to pick up a shifting of income under the monthly maintenance needs allowance rules. The community spouse has longevity, so they're expected to outlive the institutionalized spouse. And the community spouse is not going to need any additional income outside of that minimum shift. So, the maximum minimum is about $3,700. That's sufficient income for the community spouse to live their normal life. So they're happy with that amount of income. So you may want to look at purchasing the annuity for the institutionalized spouse if that's the case. You may want to consider purchasing the annuity for the community spouse as if the community spouse has high income and they're either going to receive a very little shifting of income or no shifting of income at all because their income is just above that amount. The community spouse has questionable longevity, so you're not sure if they're going to have issues soon, if they're going to predecease the institutionalized individual. And finally, is if the community spouse has a high income need. So maybe the community spouse has an income need of, $5,500 a month. That's well beyond the monthly maintenance needs allowance shift. So you want to purchase the community spouse so they can have enough income so they can sufficiently live their life in the community. As they always have. So those are some considerations on which plan is appropriate for each situation. So now we'll meet our lovely couple, John and Linda. John is an 81-year-old male. He recently entered into a nursing home. Linda was taking care of him in the home, but she could no longer handle that. So she reluctantly transferred him into the nursing home. She got the first bill, found out it was $8,000 per month. Her jaw kind of hit the floor. She's like, what can we do? I can't afford this. John needs to get the care that he needs. I need to live in the community. I have my own bills and expenses at $8,000 per month. My money's going to go quickly. We got to do something. I don't want to lose everything and not have anything to live my life on. I want to make sure John gets the care that he needs as well. So they stumbled upon you and came into your office. The first step is let's take a look at the case facts. And we're talking about the financial case facts here primarily. So our John has income from Social Security and pension of $1,800 per month. Linda's income against Social Security and pension of $1,100 per month. John's cost of care is $8,000. And when you're looking at their assets, their total countable assets, they have are $300,000 in assets. So if they did absolutely nothing and just privately paid for their care, they'd exhaust that full $300,000 in about 37 months. And by doing so, the longer you're paying for this care, the less money Linda is going to have to live. So remember, Linda's healthy right now, so she might live for next however long. So she needs money to live on, even after John passes. Assuming he passes first. So now we know the risk there that they're going to potentially eliminate all their assets in 37 months. Let's take a look at their countable assets and determine the spend down amount, the at-risk assets. So their total countable assets of $300,000, Linda, as the community spouse, is entitled to keep the home, the car, furniture, personal properties, and a community spouse resource allowance of $148,620. Now, to avoid being right on the edge of Medicaid eligibility, we're going to leave Linda a little bit less than that. So we're going to leave Linda, in this case, $145,000. The reason we're doing that is maybe they have a small bank account that they forgot about, or maybe Linda wants to keep some accounts that have fluctuated in value. Maybe she has a nice stock portfolio or mutual funds that she wants to keep. So as those goes up and down, we want to make sure we build in a little buffer there to make sure we meet the asset eligibility test. Because if Linda, if they're $1 over their asset tests, they're not gonna meet the eligibility criteria and they're not gonna qualify for Medicaid. So we want to build in a small buffer zone there. And then John, he's able to keep his individual resource allowance at $2,000. So that we have a spend down amount or at risk assets of $153,000. So the first option we're going to look at is buying the Medicaid annuity on behalf of the institutionalized individual. So John, as the institutionalized spouse, is going to take that full $153,000 and put it into a Medicaid compliant annuity that he's going to be the owner of, and he's going to be the payee of that. We're going to look at doing an income shift over to Linda, so shifting income from John over to Linda to bring Linda up to that monthly maintenance needs allowance that she's allowed to have. So that's the plan. So what does that look like? So first, purchasing the annuity, we're going to look at John's life expectancy. So since John is an 81-year-old male, we're just going to look at our life expectancy table, go to 81 in male, and we see his life expectancy is 7.91 years. So we're just simply going to multiply that number by 12 to put it on a monthly basis, because annuities are purchased in a number of whole months. So we're looking at a Medicaid life expectancy of 94.92 months. This means the maximum term of John's annuity can be 94 months. If the annuity is 95 months, it would exceed his Medicaid life expectancy and would fail that portion of the test and likely be treated as a transfer for less than fair market value. So the maximum term annuity we can use in this case is going to be 94 months. And again, being that John, the institutionalized spouse, is purchasing the annuity, we want to purchase that annuity for his maximum term of 94 months to make that payment as small as possible and to stretch that payment stream out as long as possible to increase a chance for Linda to pick up that benefit. So we put $153,000. John, as the institutionalized individual, is the owner annuitant and payee. It's going to make 94 equal monthly payments of $1,640 per month. Since John, the institutionalized spouse, is purchasing the annuity, we can name Linda as primary beneficiary with the state Medicaid agency as contingent beneficiary. So now we purchased the annuity, we spent that $153,000 down by buying the annuity, we created an income stream for John. So now we're going to apply for Medicaid. Since John's income, his total income now, $3,440, is less than his $8,000 cost of care, he's going to meet that income test. Now, if you're in an income state, you're going to want to create a Miller Trust or Qualified Income Trust for the amount of income he exceeds the income cap. Just as a side note there, if you're not in an income cap state, you don't need to worry about that. So John's income from Social Security and pension of $1,800, we add that to the Medicaid annuity income of $1,640. And again, he has total monthly income of $3,440. And John is immediately qualified for Medicaid benefits after the purchase of the annuity. So he starts receiving Medicaid. So now let's switch over to Linda, look at her income and see how much income we can shift from John. So Linda is going to be entitled to a monthly maintenance needs allowance of $3,715.50. And Linda has income from Social Security and pension of $1,100. So this means Linda is short $2,615.50. So we'll be able to shift $2,615.50 each month from John's income over to Linda. So Linda has that minimum level of income to maintain her lifestyle within the community. So now we know the income shift, we know John's total income. What is his copay going to be? So John's total income is $3,440 again from his Social Security pension plus the annuity income. Since Linda is short, since Linda's low income, but he's short that monthly maintenance needs allowance amount, we're able to shift $2,615.50 over to Linda each month. John is allowed to keep a $50 personal needs allowance for personal items, which means John's Medicaid copay in this example is going to be $774.50. Now, we didn't include any allowable medical expenses in this example. However, if John had any Medicare supplements or any other type of insurance premiums, typically that would also, reduce his copay amount. But again, just to keep everything simple, we did not include that. So John's copay to the Medicaid, what the couple is responsible for each and every month is $774.50. So what did we just do? We just took that original nursing home bill that they were paying, that $8,000 per month. By doing this planning, we've reduced that down to $774.50 per month. That's a savings of $7,225.50 per month. We took an $8,000 bill, reduced it down to $775. What a great outcome. In addition to that, we were able to increase Linda's monthly income from $1,100 up to $3,715.50. And that is sufficient for Linda to maintain her lifestyle within the community. And then ultimately, when John passes away, Linda is named as primary death beneficiary on his annuity. So she can either receive, she can either choose to continue the remaining payments or take a lump sum distribution from that annuity. So again, great result. So why use this option? Again, this assumes Linda has good longevity. She doesn't need income in addition to the amount she receives under the monthly maintenance needs allowance shift. And again, at John's passing, assuming Linda is still living, she'll be able to receive the remaining amount in the annuity. So again, great outcome for this fact pattern. So now let's take the same fact pattern and look at what happens if we were to purchase the Medicaid annuity in the name of the community spouse for Linda. So in this case, very similar, except Linda is going to take the $153,000 spend down amount and purchase a Medicaid compliant annuity. So we're eliminating that $153,000. We're able to immediately qualify John for Medicaid benefits. So with Linda purchasing the annuity as a community spouse, since they do not have a minor and or disabled child, the state is going to have to be named as primary death beneficiary. So when might you want to look at this plan, have the community spouse buy the annuity? Is if the community spouse needs more income than what they would receive under income shifting, or maybe the couple again has high income where they would not receive a shifting of income regardless, or maybe a very little shifting of income, and the longevity of the community spouse is questionable. You think that they may predecease the institutionalized spouse, so in which case we could use a shorter term for the community spouse. So now we got to determine the length of the plan. So again, we have a lot of options here, being that Linda, the community spouse, is buying the annuity. But first, we want to determine what the maximum term is. So Linda, being an 80-year-old female, again, we can look at her life expectancy table, and we see it's 9.83 years. Multiply that by 12, we get 117.96 months. This means the maximum term annuity that Linda can use is 117 months. So the shortest term annuity available is 2 months. And we know in this case, with Linda being 80 and her life expectancy, the maximum term she can purchase is 117. So we can purchase an annuity between 2 months and 117 months, whatever your wishes are. So this is where you're going to want to have a conversation with the client, talk about monthly income, look at their expenses, see what they want to do, see if the state's recovery is a concern. You may want to use a shorter term annuity. Or if Linda is in poor health or questionable health, you might want to use a shorter term annuity, again, to get the funds back sooner. You might want to use a longer term if maybe Linda just wants the comfort of knowing that she's going to get that income stream for as long as possible, and that makes her comfortable. And she doesn't, that income stream that's generated from the annuity is going to be sufficient to meet her income needs. So, really, it's just about having a conversation with the client, going over the pros and cons, going shorter versus going longer, and choosing a term that fits for your client. So in this case, you had that conversation with her, and you determined that a 36-month annuity is a good term given her circumstances. So you take that full $153,000, you put it in a 36-month Medicaid compliant annuity where Linda is the owner, annuitant, and payee. So it'll make 36 equal monthly payments of $4,280 to Linda. Since they don't have any minor and or disabled children, The state Medicaid agency will be named as primary death beneficiary for the amount of benefits provided on behalf of John. And then Linda's going to name their children as secondary beneficiaries. So in the event that she were predeceased, the annuity, and there's still money left over after the state's been repaid, their kids would receive the remaining benefit in the annuity. So now we've purchased the annuity. John is immediately qualified for Medicaid benefits by means of purchasing the annuity. So what does that do to our income? So Linda's income, again, from Social Security and pension is $1,100. By purchasing the Medicaid compliant annuity, that's creating an additional $4,280. So her total income is now $5,380. Again, Linda can have unlimited income, so that's not gonna be any issue whatsoever for Linda. So now let's take a look at the monthly maintenance needs allowance shift. Since Linda is entitled to $3,715.50 and her income is $5,380. She is not entitled to any of John's income because her income exceeds the monthly maintenance needs allowance, which again is completely acceptable. It's not going to affect John's Medicaid eligibility. She will just not receive a shifting of income from John. So again, that's completely fine and acceptable. So let's take a look at John's copay amount. He has his income, again, Social Security pension of $1,800. We are not shifting income to Linda because Linda's income exceeds her minimum amount. John is still allowed to keep his personal needs allowance of $50, which means his Medicaid copay amount, the amount he's responsible for each and every month, is $1,750. So again, let's take a look at the economic results. Still a fantastic result where John, they were paying $8,000 per month. Now they're paying $1,750. So they experience a monthly savings of $6,250. On the same hand, Linda is able to increase her income to $5,380, which is more than what she would have received under the monthly maintenance needs allowance rules. And by opting to use a shorter term annuity, we're increasing the probability that Linda is going to outlive the 36-month annuity, thus reducing the risk of her predecease in the term of the annuity and the state being able to recover against it. So why use this option? Well, Linda may have some high monthly income needs to sustain her lifestyle within the community. You know, maybe she lives at a senior living facility or something like that, but anyway, you know, she has that income to pay for what she does in the community. You know, the income shift alone, she would not have sufficient income to meet her needs. And also by using that shorter term annuity, again, as long as she lives at 36 months, she'll receive the full amount back, so she'll protect 100% of the assets, and she's able to, you know, do with those funds as she pleases. One question I get a lot from attorneys is what happens if Linda doesn't spend that large monthly payment down each month, and her assets then creep up above the community spouse resource allowance limits. Well, after the initial qualification of John, Medicaid is no longer concerned with the assets of Linda. So Linda could effectively win the lottery. It would not affect John's Medicaid eligibility as long as it's after qualification. So if Linda accumulates those payments, it builds up her asset base in excess of the community spouse resource allowance limits, that's fine. Again, Medicaid is no longer concerned with Linda's assets as the community spouse after John's initial Medicaid qualification. So now let's just quickly compare the two plans. So the Medicaid annuity purchased on behalf of the institutionalized spouse, John's gonna be the owner. Linda's gonna be the primary beneficiary. Whereas if we purchase it on behalf of the community spouse, Linda would be the owner and the state Medicaid agency would be primary death beneficiary. When we bought it on behalf of an institutionalized spouse, Linda's monthly income is $3,715.50. Whereas when she bought her annuity, her income was increased to $5,380. John's copay under the institutionalized spouse, John buying the annuity, because of that income shift, was only $774.50, whereas the community spouse annuity we're looking at a copay of $1,750. If John were to pass away, under the annuity that John purchased on behalf of the institutionalized spouse, Linda would be able to cash out the annuity at that point in time at John's death because she's primary death beneficiary. Whereas if John passes away under the community spouse annuity, that's not going to have any bearing on Linda's annuity because it's going to be based on her lifetime. So if John passes away and Linda's still living, Linda's just going to receive those remaining monthly payments for the remainder of the contract, as John's death is not going to have any bearing on Linda's annuity. So what happens if John dies after 12 months? Again, on the institutionalized spouse buying the annuity, Linda being the primary death beneficiary, there would have been about $20,000 of payments made out of the annuity, which means there's about $133,000 in change left in the annuity that Linda would receive. And again, she can take a lump sum distribution from the annuity or elect to continue to receive the monthly payments from the annuity. Whereas on the community spouse side, if John dies after passed away after 12 months, the annuity would still continue those payments until either Linda passes away or until after the 24th payment, she would have received all the monthly payments from the annuity. So again, the passing away of John on Linda's annuity is not going to have any bearing, as Linda will have to continue the stream until she passes away or until that payment stream ends. So when is each plan appropriate to purchase the annuity under the institutionalized spouse's name? Again, if the community spouse has low income and you can get a nice shifting of income from under the MNMA rules, the community spouse is in good health, so you're fairly certain that the community spouse is going to outlive the institutionalized spouse. And the community spouse, the MNMA income amount is going to be sufficient to cover their living costs within the community. You may want to consider purchasing the annuity under the community spouse's name, is if the couple of the community spouse has high income and they're not going to receive an income shift or be a very little income shift. Maybe the community spouse is in questionable health, so you want to use a shorter term annuity to get the funds back to the community spouse. Or the community spouse has high income needs to support their lifestyles in the community, that they need more income than what they would be entitled to under the minimum shift. So those are some things to consider. At the end of the day, you just want to choose a plan that works well for you and your client. You know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. I know the most popular one is just to have the community spouse purchase the annuity. But again, especially if the community spouse has low income and we can work a nice income shift there, you may want to consider purchasing the annuity in the name of the institutionalized spouse. So again, just look at the case facts, couple as a whole. Choose whichever option seems best for you and your clients. So if you want to learn more, I encourage you all to request a free copy of the Krauss Report, which goes in depth into the Medicaid planning, Medicaid annuities, case studies, Medicaid figures, things like that. And you can request a free copy at medicaidannuity.com/Krauss Report. And I think I don't know if we want to take a couple questions or end it. We're at the time, so whatever you want to do, Elisa.
All right. Well, let's see. Maybe we could sneak in one or two questions here. Can an IRA be converted to an MCA?
Yes, we can purchase an IRA Medicaid-compliant annuity. We just have to move those funds pursuant with IRS regulations, but yes, we can purchase an IRA Medicaid-compliant annuity, so we can preserve the pre-tax status of those funds.
All right, and probably the last question we'll get in here. Is the community spouse ever required to help pay for the institutionalized spouse's care with the income they receive from the MCA?
Generally speaking, no. There are, I believe, Illinois and New York do have a spousal share of cost. I'm not sure how active they are in requesting that, but generally speaking, no. The community spouse would not be responsible for any of the institutionalized spouse's care costs, just institutionalized spouse's income, their copay would go to the nursing home, and then Medicaid would pick up everything else.
Perfect. Well, that is all the time we have for questions today. If we didn't get to your question, we will follow up with you later this week. A recording of this webinar will be available shortly through your Attorney Access account. If you're not yet a member of Attorney Access, head on over to medicaidannuity.com/join to get started. Thank you so much, Aaron, for your great presentation today. And thank you to everyone for joining us and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for watching. I hope you enjoy and learn something. Take care.